with Adam and Eve and closed with the death of the last apostle about the year 100. The unnecessary, that does not mean useless, but revelation that is not necessary for salvation, but authentic, are all those many communications that God makes to his chosen souls, which the church has approved, but though useful are not necessary for acceptance and therefore for salvation. Secondly, the revelation beginning with Adam and Eve and closing with John is called public because it is intended for the whole human race. Private revelations are called private because they are meant either just for the person who receives them or for special specific needs as directed by God or by Christ or Our Lady, depending on the nature of the communication. And thirdly, private revelations are useful. They help to interpret public revelation. So they are not useless. They help us to understand, for example, in what year that Pope Pius IX defined Mary's Immaculate Conception?
1854.
Who said? 1854. All right. In what year did Our Lady appear to Bernadette Soubirous at Lourdes? 1858. All right. How thoughtful of Our Lady. She waited 4 years and then proceeded to identify herself as the Immaculate Conception. Who would doubt that the miracles of Lourdes, now for over a century, have helped to appreciate, confirm, and understand the Immaculate Conception? Right? So Bernadette received private revelation. What's the function of a genuine private revelation? To better understand, better explain, more appreciate, more clearly grasp, more faithfully put into practice, some mystery of public revelation. By now, we come back now to the public revelation. By now, the whole human race has received God's revealed word. Because at least the primitive revelation, which has permeated the civilized world, in fact the whole world already, before the coming of the patriarchs. In any case, when St. Paul, in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, says that without faith, no one pleases God, which the church says, without faith, nobody can be saved. That's a safe statement, because everyone by now has access to God's revelation. So much, and I'm ashamed to say it, for revelation. Now, faith. As we enter the subject of faith, and what we may do, because I would like to follow the plan, 1 o'clock is to be the end of this class, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we'll get as far as we can, then we'll continue the next time we meet. The idea being we will cover the matter for the course, ideally finish within a given period, but if we can't, we will continue. I would like to talk about the qualities of the true faith. Let me first identify these qualities and then explain each. The true faith is divine, it's called divine faith. Secondly, it is reasonable. Thirdly, it is mysterious. Fourth, voluntary. Fifth, supernatural. Sixth, infallibly certain. Seventh, it is Catholic. And eighth, it is permanent. These eight qualities, by the way, are part of the teaching of the Church. All eight have somewhere been defined. Before we start, however, to explore the qualities, let me give you a definition. Faith is the assent of the human mind to God's revelation based on the recognition of God's authority, who can neither deceive nor be deceived. Faith, then, is the assent of the human mind to what God has revealed, based on the recognition of God's authority, who can neither deceive nor be deceived. As we go through the qualities of faith, the definition will, I think, become more clear, but I think it's good to have a definition, and then explain what we're talking about. First, then, the true faith is called divine faith. It is called divine faith for three reasons. First, in what we believe. What do we believe? What God revealed. Second, it is called divine faith in why we believe. The motive is God's authority. Whenever we believe anyone and accept that person's word for something being true, something that we ourselves do not understand, the two qualities that we always look for, at least implicitly, is does the person know what they're talking about? And are they telling the truth? If they have those qualities, we are ready to believe them. Having those two qualities, knowledge and integrity, is called authority, just to know the meaning of the word. A person's authority to have his word accepted on faith means the person has adequate knowledge and has the moral integrity or honesty of telling what that person thinks. In God's case, who would doubt that God knows what he's talking about, and who could question God's veracity? The only question is, did God reveal it? That's the only question. If he said it, man has no choice. He must believe, and it's an obligation. Third, the true faith is called divine in how we believe. We believe with the help of divine grace. We can believe a lot of things without grace. In fact, there are some things that people believe that God wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. But when it comes to the true faith, either he gives the grace or we don't believe. So summary. The true faith is called divine in what we believe, what God revealed, in why we believe it. Because, and we can know this from reason, that if God reveals something, he must be believed. He is all wise and all good. He is all wise because he cannot be deceived. And he is all good, and therefore he will not deceive. And it is called divine faith in how we believe, with the indispensable assistance of divine grace. No grace, no faith. So much for quality number one. Quality number two. The true faith is reasonable. How is the true faith reasonable? It is, again, reasonable in three ways. Things just seem to work out that way. It is, first of all, reasonable in not being contrary to reason. Whatever God reveals, reason tells us, must be true. We may not see it. Well, so much the worse for us. But no big surprise, because we can't see something. Therefore, divine faith, which we can now call it divine faith, is reasonable because God is the author of both reason and revelation. And God could not contradict himself. Is that a reasonable statement? I may not understand the Trinity. So much the worse for me. But don't touch the Trinity. What God reveals must be true. Why? Because he revealed it. And that we cannot contradict what my reason, as limited as it is, can understand. Second, and how I like to emphasize this, how I would like to spend an hour on this next one, which, by the way, when I have the time, I often do in class. The true faith is reasonable because it is consistent with reason. It satisfies the mind. It gives peace to the mind. And if a person tries to practice sincerely what God has revealed, there is also joy and happiness in one's life. As a matter of fact, there is no peace outside. Anyone who contradicts what God has revealed will not be at peace. And third, the true faith is reasonable because it is acceptable on the grounds of reason. Reason can establish the premises or the grounds or the basis for accepting what God has revealed. What are those grounds for accepting what God has revealed? Ultimately, the grounds for accepting what God has revealed are miracles. God, in other words, makes sure that when he reveals, he will enable the human mind to see that God entered history and made a revelation by testifying through miracles worked by the person who claims to be in communication with the deity. Thus, remember the famous story of Elijah and the false prophets of Baal? Remember that? Oh, it's a delightful story. He was getting nowhere, and there were several hundreds of them, the prophets, and poor Elijah was quite alone. So he was inspired to lay down this challenge. He called the people and he said, "Nobody is listening to me. Look, what do you think of this? That the prophets of Baal erect an altar and lay some sacrifice on that altar. I'll do the same. I'll build an altar to Yahweh and slaughter the sacrifice and place it on the altar. Then the prophets of Baal will ask Baal to come down and consume the sacrifice, but without fire, no matches, no flint. And I'll do the same. Whosoever sacrifice is consumed, will you people agree that he's the true God?" I like the expression. The crowd shouted, "A very good idea." They all thought to themselves, "Will it work?" Well, Elijah said, "Let them do it first." They built the sacrifice and told them to pray to their God. They prayed and they all shouting, and he said, "Shout louder, maybe he's asleep." And they're already covered with blood from having cut themselves to make their prayer more effective. Nothing happened. Then Elijah, put this sacrifice on the altar, then had water poured once, twice, was it three times? And then you can just read behind Elijah's Hebrew, "Lord, everything is at stake. You've got to come through." If this doesn't work, that's the end of Elijah. So he prayed, and then, you know what happened? Talk about a holocaust. The sacrifice, the altar, everything. Do you follow the logic? The real test of our faith being reasonable, that our minds can prove, and don't let go of that verb, prove, that God made a revelation, is that God works miracles to prove that he made a revelation. And in Christ's case, what is the crowning sign or proof of Christ's claims? His resurrection. With that, we've got six more to go. We will have more next time we meet. We will have the other class. What time do we meet? Now, I thought, by the way, it was brought to my attention. Would you mind if we waited until 2 o'clock? Would you mind, I think, for the other class? Would you mind? I think we rush it. 2 o'clock, we meet here for the next class on the history of religious life. Shall we see the angels? In the name of the Father, and the Father.